This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I absolutely defy you to tell me you saw this one coming.
It is a great honor to be invited by you, Mr. President. A great, great honor. Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, the 31st day of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. In diplomatic circles, the meeting today between Donald Trump and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto would be called a bilateral, a bilat for short. In political circles, it would be called, first of all, amazing. Second of all, a great photo op, I guess. In economic circles, it was, well, interesting. Mr. Trump has made no bones about immigration, Mexican immigration specifically, and the economic impact thereof being one of the key issues in his case to be elected to the White House. He is, in fact, giving a speech on that topic this evening. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been on the story for us all day long. She's on the line from our bureau in Washington. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, Kai.
So Mr. Trump and the Mexican president as well said that the invitation was tendered. It was given. Mr. Trump took it. What did they speak about?
They spoke about lots of things, of course, lots about immigration, the topic of Mr. Trump's speech tonight, as you mentioned. They talked about crime and all of the traffic that goes back and forth across the border in terms of human trafficking, drug trafficking, money laundering and everything. They also talked about NAFTA, which Mr. Trump said, well, here's what he said about it.
I shared my strong view that NAFTA has been a far greater benefit to Mexico than it has been to the United States, and that it must be improved upon to make sure that workers, and so important, in both countries benefit from fair and reciprocal trade.
He talked a lot about trade in his comments. Mm-hmm. Some of the numbers were a little bit off, but that was obviously a big topic of conversation for him.
There was also a press conference afterward that, honestly, Donald Trump kind of jumped in and ran from the get-go. What else did they cover in that?
They covered the wall a little bit, but that was just because some of the reporters were literally jumping out of their seats trying to ask about this wall and what they said about it. And according to Mr. Trump, here's how that conversation went.
We did discuss the wall. We didn't discuss payment of the wall. That'll be for a later date. This was a very preliminary meeting.
Which is a little bit strange because the wall has been such a huge issue for Trump from the very beginning of his campaign all the way up until now. It's been the wall, the wall, the wall. So it's a bit surprising that in this setting he didn't talk about who would pay for the wall, because Trump has said over and over again that Mexico will pay for the wall, which obviously many Mexicans have a problem with.
There was some degree of subtlety in what Mr. Trump said today, specifically when he was talking about NAFTA and some of the other economic issues in the Americas writ large. He kept using the phrase in this hemisphere. We want to keep economic growth in this hemisphere. How did you read that? What did you take it to mean?
I was really confused by that, because which hemisphere is he talking about? If it's the northern hemisphere, then we're also talking about Europe, a lot of Africa, and definitely parts of Asia, which are some of the places that he's talked about we are losing jobs to. But if he's talking about the western hemisphere, then you're not only including Mexico, you're also including all of South America. So it was a little bit unclear. I think what he was trying to get at is that it's important to keep trade and business and economic growth and wealth amongst America's friends, like the NAFTA countries, Mexico, Canada, and the United States.
And that, in fact, is what President Peña Nieto was talking about, right? NAFTA has worked out well for all three countries involved. He tried to very much play the—he didn't go after Mr. Trump, as he well might have, given some of the things Mr. Trump has said.
Right. And actually, you know, the United States, even though there have definitely been job losses that came after NAFTA, depending on which economist you talk to, there's definitely been some growth. Even though Mexico exports, you know, 80% of its products to the United States, Mexico is the United States' third largest trading partner, and there's investment on both sides. I was down at the border just earlier this year, and there's massive amounts of trade that goes back and forth every single day. And I think Mexico's president was really trying to emphasize that the partnerships that exist right now are beneficial for both parties.
Donald Trump's speech on immigration coming up in Arizona later this evening. Kimberly Adams on the line from our bureau in Washington. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street today, oh, come on, who are we kidding? Not only are traders waiting for the Friday jobs report to do their buying and selling, but Trump in Mexico. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you live near a port or a busy railroad line, you have quite possibly seen shipping containers belonging to the big Korean shipping company Hanjin. The name is usually printed right there on the side in big white letters. That's how you know. Today, as it happens, Hanjin declared bankruptcy. And while it is based in Seoul, Korea, a long ways away, Hanjin's filing speaks to a global industry that is in some trouble. Shipping volume is down worldwide, just as a whole load of new cargo ships are coming online. Ashley Montite has more.
Shipping hit a crisis in 2008 as demand for goods plunged. It's never fully returned. John Butler is CEO of the World Shipping Council. He says after the financial crisis, when oil prices were spiking,
there was an expectation that the global economy would come back much more strongly than it did. A lot of companies took what was then a rational decision to build more, larger, newer ships,
which ultimately they've never filled. So now he says they can't command their usual shipping rates and they're suffering. William Bennett is an analyst with London-based Vessels Values. He sees it a little differently.
Shipping's a very weird market compared to anything else. They're very irrational ship owners.
He says they're a competitive lot in the good times. If you're building, I will too. And now they're stuck with a glut. He covers the cargo industry and says there are far more ships coming into service this year for dry goods like coal and grain than there is demand for those commodities. And even though Americans have been shopping lately, imports have fallen here too. Jessica Dankert directs retail operations for the Retail Industry Leaders Association.
People are spending money, but the retailers are trying to find ways to be more effective and efficient at meeting those demands. And that results in price pressures across the board, including with ocean shipping.
She says retailers want to do everything they can to make sure unsold inventory doesn't linger on shelves. And that means ordering less in the first place. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
With Donald Trump in Mexico today and his policy speech tonight, an immigration story now from this side of the border about what happens after people enter the United States illegally. This fiscal year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE in the vernacular, had a budget of $6.3 billion. That's a 17% boost over last year, part of which increase is going to pay for the 34,000 beds that ICE runs at its various detention centers around the country. One of those centers in Alabama has become a long-term depository for people waiting to be deported or who are fighting their deportation orders. And now there is a push to shut it down. From Gadsden, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports.
At the Etowah County Detention Center in Gadsden, about 70 miles outside of Birmingham, almost none of the immigrant detainees is from Alabama. ICE picked them up in places like California, Texas, New York, the Midwest. There are a little over 300 detainees here from Jamaica, El Salvador, Somalia.
My name is Luis Fernando Estela Gomez. I'm from Colombia.
He came to the U.S. on a tourist visa 22 years ago and never left. In 2010, he got arrested for selling stolen wedding dresses and Viagra. Estela has been at Etowah for 3 years after spending a year at a New Jersey detention center.
I don't imagine that this is going to take that long. And when I get here, you know, I found out that it's people here being like 7 years, 6 years, you know, all kind of time. So then I figured it out. It was going to be a long run.
Immigrant detention is supposed to be brief, weeks or months at the most. But at Etowah, many inmates are held for years while they go through the legal system. The reason so many detainees are funneled into this Alabama detention center from other states has to do with ICE's bottom line, says Jessica Vosburgh, an immigrant rights attorney in Birmingham.
Etowah offers ICE the lowest bargain basement per diem, per detainee price in the entire country. So it's cheaper to house people there.
Much cheaper. On average, for every detainee, ICE pays detention centers about $124 a day. At Etowah, ICE pays only $45.
And so it's ICE's preferred facility for the people that they are planning to hold in detention for a long time.
Some ICE contracts offer guaranteed minimums. In other words, ICE promises to pay for at least a certain number of detainee beds to be filled. These contracts are worth tens of millions of dollars. Some centers, many of them private prisons, are benefiting. But in cash-strapped Etowah County, Commissioner Tim Schoate says the county barely breaks even.
There's no money. There's no profit in this thing.
I asked him how it's worth keeping the facility open then.
In my opinion, speaking for myself, it's not.
Then again, he says it's easier than shutting it down. And on the plus side, he says it does generate jobs. Silky Shah, co-director of Detention Watch Network, says in some cases, especially poorer areas, a detention center might not be profitable.
But the reality is that because these contracts have now existed for some time, these counties have come to depend on it.
Because detainees are housed at Etowah for so long at such cheap rates, Shah says it's created what critics call some of the worst conditions for detainees in the country. One group made up of human rights advocates and religious groups in Alabama is calling for the government to shut down Etowah. The group holds rallies, circulates petitions, and points out human rights abuses.
A lot of concerns about food, outdoor recreation there, legal access, due process issues.
There's no in-person visitation. The outdoor recreation area isn't actually outdoors. It's a small area with bars near the ceiling to let in some light and air. The detention center is one wing of the county jail, which sits across the street from the county commission offices in downtown Gadsden. There's also a bail bondsman, a pawn shop, a law firm, and a barbecue place. Natalie Barton, spokeswoman for the Etowah County Sheriff's Office, says the detention center has passed every inspection it's undergone, whether it's through ICE or an NGO.
We run a very safe and secure facility where individuals are well taken care of and given the necessary needs to sustain life.
ICE wouldn't agree to an interview. In the meantime, detainees like Estela will keep waiting. It doesn't look good. He's out of money for lawyers. After 4 years in detention for a nonviolent crime, Estela thinks he's paid his dues. Other detainees gladly take deportation in hopes that one day they'll return to this country again. In Gadsden, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And I must say, I was surprised. I was surprised there was only one woman on the list.
What is more rare than female CEOs? How about highly paid female CEOs? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 53 points today, 0.2%, 18,400 on the nose. The NASDAQ slipped 9 points, about a 10%, 52.13. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.2%, 21.70. We talked about the shipping industry hitting some really rough seas. German shipper Hapag-Lloyd barely budged. Taiwan-based Evergreen Marine lifted 0.2%. China shipping container lines dropped nearly 0.5% today. With Mr. Trump down in Mexico, we head across the border for a look at a couple of Mexico-based companies. There's Coca-Cola FEMSA, franchise bottler and distributor of Coke beverages. It spilled 0.6% lower today. Grupo Televisa, it's a media company, off 0.2%. Bonds fell Yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This may be the day, the very day, that you first hear the name of the man who could wind up as the next Treasury Secretary of these United States. Steve Mnuchin is the name. His unpaid position at the moment is as National Finance Chairman for the Donald J. Trump for President campaign. That title, though, tells you only a tiny bit about who Mr. Mnuchin is. Max Abelson fills in some of the gaps in a piece out in the new Bloomberg Business Week. Max, it's good to talk to you.
So glad to be back.
Who is this guy? He kind of came out of political nowhere, right?
Man, he sure did. But Steven Mnuchin's been around. I mean, this guy has had basically like the most prestigious career. I was thinking that if I was like creating a character for a novel, you know, it would be like him. His dad was a Goldman Sachs partner. He went to Yale, where incidentally he drove a Porsche.
Nice.
He went to Goldman Sachs and made partner. This guy ran hedge fund money for George Soros and Eddie Lampert, his old Yale roommate.
Yeah.
Not only did he invest in Hollywood blockbusters, but he bought a bank. In the meantime, no politics experience at all. And this is the man we're talking about who's now in charge of fundraising money for Donald Trump.
And he basically stumbled into that gig, too.
Stumbling is not too stretch, you know, not too far off. He was going to go to a dinner party downtown in April, but he was invited last minute to Trump Tower for the New York primary victory night. He bumps into Trump. Trump invites him up on stage. He sees this crowd. He's like, wow, this is amazing. The next day, Donald Trump invites him to be his national finance chairman. And that's the very important job that he has today.
And he gets the job. He walks in the door. He's got basically no staff. He's got no political fundraising network, neither he nor Mr. Trump. How does he do what he had been tasked to do then?
The first thing to know about the way Donald Trump is raising money and what his machine looks like is that it looks nothing like fundraising machines, either Republicans in previous years or what he's up against with Hillary Clinton, who spent decades cultivating this incredible network of donors. Now, that doesn't mean Donald Trump wouldn't like to be making getting a lot of money from rich people. In fact, that's what his strategy entails. But in order to do that, what Steven Mnuchin is doing, Zach Mitre, my colleague, and I wrote about in Business Week, is that they're basically doing like a classic Trump move. You know, in the same way that Trump would rely on other people to make like the cologne or the condos that he would then say, these are Donald Trump products. That's kind of what they're doing with the fundraising machine. It's basically the RNC's machine that Donald Trump is relying on in a way that we've never seen before.
They are putting the Trump brand on it, which is what Trump has done his whole career.
That's exactly right. Just like Trump's Success cologne, which I own, incidentally.
What does it smell like? Is it any good?
It's terrific. It smells like success.
All right. You have quotes throughout this piece in which Mnuchin's friends basically say, I have no idea what he's doing, this man. He's got no political experience, no nothing. And you came up with a line. You figured it out. It is for him the trade of a lifetime. Explain that.
You know, if you were to look at the way statisticians look at this election, the chances given to Donald Trump are not great for making the White House. Let's call it 25% is the shot he's given right now, if we were to just pick a number.
Mm-hmm.
On Wall Street, though, those aren't terrible odds if the payoff is golden. And for Steven Mnuchin, I think it's fair to say, at least the theory that's running around New York and L.A. among the set that knows him, is that this guy has spotted an opportunity. And he, look, it's going to cost him a couple months of work. And look, people might be clucking their tongues. But if Steven Mnuchin makes it into a job like Treasury Secretary, the quote he gave us is, people won't be asking why he took this job.
Max Abelson in Bloomberg Business Week this week, along with Zach Mitre, the other guy on the byline, about Steve Mnuchin, the guy raising money for Donald Trump. Max, thanks very much.
That's so my pleasure.
Instagram announced today that finally, at long last, it's going to get right with the rest of the smartphone and tablet-using universe. The company's latest update will let you pinch on an image to zoom in if you like. About time, I say. But before Instagram, really before Instagram, pictures used a whole different kind of technology.
My name is Jerry Spagnoli, and I make daguerreotypes. Daguerreotype is photographic process that was introduced in 1839 And it was the first photographic process that the public was aware of. The image is formed on a sheet of polished silver. You'll notice immediately that it has a highly reflective surface, and if it's held at a particular angle, it'll just look like a mirror with a vague image on it. But if you hold it correctly and light it correctly, it has a very beautiful and rich photograph on it. Basically, you had to look at the old manuals and maybe if you could find some old equipment and then duplicate it. So I learned how to, you know, do some simple woodworking, some simple welding. And actually, in some ways, it's very simple. The chemistry of it is very simple. But there's a lot of finesse points. Very little things, small things make big differences. You know, you don't do like pictures of what you're about to eat with a daguerreotype. You know, it's not a casual process. When you have a portrait of somebody, you know that that person sat in front of that piece of metal. And in fact, then were handed that piece of metal and they probably put it in their pocket and left with it.
Jerry Spagnoli. He's a daguerreotypist, I guess you'd say. You can follow me on Instagram if you like. You can find me at Kai Rizdahl. The show is there as well at Marketplace APN. There are few things more rare in corporate America than CEOs of big public companies who are women or people of color. Case in point, the greater Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area. The Dallas Morning News published a list not too long ago ranking the highest paid CEOs of public companies in town 1 to 100. You know where I'm going with this, right? Just a single woman on that list. Lauren Silverman from KERA in Dallas went to meet her and to talk about why it matters to have women in the C-suite.
Pam Patsley is used to being both a powerful and a petite woman. The first thing she does in the 15th floor conference room where we meet is adjust the height of her chair down.
Okay, get that up.
So that her black ballet flats reach the ground. It's something she has to do a lot. There's nothing small about her salary, though. Last year, Patsley made almost $11 million as CEO of MoneyGram International, one of the world's largest cash transfer firms. In 2009, right after the financial crisis, the company was in trouble. She was hired to steer the behemoth to safety. All $1.2 billion of revenue and 200,000 agent locations. And she did, successfully. Patsley comes from a family of teachers, but she always had her eye on making money.
So it was really more driven, less about position, but just really like achieving and earning money, to be perfectly candid.
She assumed it wasn't unusual for that to be a woman's goal. So when she saw her name on that recent lineup of top paid public company CEOs in the Dallas area.
And I must say I was surprised. I was surprised there was only one woman on the list.
Especially as Dallas is a center for corporate headquarters. Maybe she shouldn't have been surprised, though. In the S&P 500, there are only 22 female CEOs, which is about 4.5%. That's what Alyssa Sangster wants to change. She's executive director of the Forte Foundation, an Austin-based group that seeks to put more women in top-tier business careers.
I think everybody thinks this problem is solved, and I think you see evidence in the media that there are a lot of women leaders out there, but it's not reflected in the business world in those top CEO spots.
She says by not having more women in the C-suite, companies could be losing money.
There are many, many research studies and cases that have been made for why having more women in leadership makes a difference in your corporation's overall return on investment, your return on equity.
Really? Good for the bottom line? Entrepreneur Karen Rubin was skeptical. She's with the Boston-based trading platform Quantopian. So she ran a simulation investing only in publicly traded women-led companies from 2002 to 2014.
And it outperformed the S&P 500 pretty dramatically with 200% greater gains than the S&P 500 had over the same time period.
You heard right, 200% greater gains. Rubin was shocked.
I've spent a year and a half now trying to disprove it and understand if there's a fallacy in my thinking or in the code that I wrote. I have not been able to find something that completely disproves it yet.
But you can't stick a woman in the CEO spot and expect profits to magically rise. In fact, a study by the Peterson Institute for International Economics shows one female figurehead isn't enough. In the research, profitability only went up when multiple women were in corporate leadership. In Austin, Alyssa Sangster is now coaching Fortune 500 companies to groom young women for these top jobs by reaching them at the very start of their careers.
Instead of having kind of this mysterious career path, they're showing them the step-by-step ways that they would make it to the top.
MoneyGram's Pam Patsley is all about giving the mentorship she didn't have. She tells young women, find something you're passionate about, work hard, and don't be afraid to adjust a few chairs. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which American Airlines says it has found the problem with modern-day air travel. No, it's not the delays. It's not the TSA lines or the overcrowded planes and the person in front of you kneecapping you when they recline their seat. No, it's us, the traveler. American's got a new ad campaign going in which it asks literally what it means to be a great flyer. On that list, always asking before you raise the window shade, bringing noise-canceling headphones so crying babies don't bother you. Also, and I have to say this one happens to be true, always giving the armrest to the person stuck in the middle seat. Always. I don't want to tell you again. I'm serious. They get it. The armrest thing. It's real. All right. We're done. Got to go. The Dow off 53 points today, 0.2%. The Nasdaq off 9 points, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 off 5 points, 0.2%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizzo. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.